You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
You know, we had so much fun last week with Dr. Mark Fitchett from the council. We said, Mark, you got to come back again because we just had, we're trying to put 25 pounds of rice into a 20-pound bag. This doesn't work. We ran out of time. But if you were with us last time, we talked about some of the stuff that went on in the last meetings that were held in Samoa that they all just got back from. And I was teasing everybody last week about meetings coming up in Rome for heaven's sake. I thought, where's that? Is that near Samoa? No, this is Rome. Rome. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think, Mark, where we sort of left off last week was, you know, trying to agree. Not only do we have our own stocks here of tuna, but that we also have stocks from other places. And there is science to be able to differentiate between the two. And before we do anything, let's talk a little bit about that with respect to Big Eye. Because a lot of people think when they go to the auction all the time, they see ahi. And what they don't realize is there's yellowfin ahi and there's Big Eye ahi. Aren't we a Big Eye fishery?
Have a substantial, our longline fishery is a Big Eye fishery.
Yeah, yeah.
But what a lot of folks don't realize is that we do both the shallow set and deep set do catch a significant number of yellowfin.
Outside the islands.
Yeah. And we also have a substantial small boat fishery here. When I say small boat, I mean hand line, ikashibi, palahi, troll, that do catch a sizable volume of yellowfin,
and they are in the waters maintained by the council. I mean, you know, right now you got to understand that what we're doing here with the council gang is explaining that the DLNR, that the state has territorial waters, and where the council's purview picks up is at that line. Fish don't know which side of the line
it's
the
federal waters. Yeah, and most of the fishing effort that we've been seeing has been in federal waters, which is under council purview. A lot of the catch, so at the council meeting, American Samoa, I provided some maps of reported catch and fishing efforts in Hawaii on the DAR grids, the Department of, they have what's the Fisher Reporting System grids. And so I showed that up and showed that we get a little brown spot, which is a lot of fishing effort and catch in the seamounts. And then along the grids around the main Hawaiian islands, outside of 3 miles is where a high substantial amount of product is being caught, and not just for ahi, but of our billfishes and manchong and some of these other species.
And by the way, it every time you bring up something that we haven't talked about for a while, I think, oh, I got to ask Mark about that. When we talk about pinnacles and when we talk about mounts, seamounts, that the action, if you will, is where there's something.
Yeah.
It's not just bottomless, no bottom, 15 miles deep here, you're not going to catch any fish. I'm sure they're fishing the table, but you have no idea where they are. When you know by what geographical locations where the high points are, that's where the food chains are. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the fishermen know that. Yeah. And I talking to, I need, one of the things I want to do is get to spend more time talking to our small boat fishery here in Oahu. I talked to a lot of folks in Kona and Hilo side. On the Big Island, but you know, there's an intersection of science and art, and a lot of these guys who go fishing, they understand fish behavior about as good as any PhD does, but they also know how to orient their fishing activity to these features, and it's impressive. It's like I don't know what other way to put it, but say there's an art to it. And the amount of talent a lot of these folks have here in Hawaii is unfounded. It's not seen anywhere.
Interesting thing came up a couple of weeks ago. We were spending time with Roy Morioka, my good buddy, who is one of the most gifted bottom fishermen, deep seven bottom fishermen there are. And we're talking about right now, because of the global change in the water warming, that their sharks aren't leaving like they used to. So in that 100 fathom, above 100 fathoms, they're swimming around, and half the fish coming up, they catch in the bottom. Yeah. Boom. And it all of a sudden became a harsh reality on how these things all interact with each other, because you don't think about losing a fish once you've got it that close to the surface.
Yeah, and we got a shark depredation project ongoing and that we're going to start up with a colleague at the University of Hawaii, Carl Meyer, in Guam and the Northern Marianas.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Because we're dealing with the same issue, even in our pelagic troll fisheries.
Can we get him in? Let's try to get him in one of these times. You know?
Yeah, we should.
See, if he can come in and join us.
He's a smart guy. Yeah, he's got a nice British accent.
Okay. Anyway, I think that's important. And I also made mention before that a lot of us are every now and again fortunate enough to catch hebby, and hebby is part of the fishery. I mean, you know, it used to be. I think it was probably considered bycatch by most of the guys before. But what's going on? You have a new study going on. You want to tag these fish. What information or what data are you trying to achieve?
Well, you know, hebby. Well, going back, my PhD work was on sailfish.
Yeah.
And
by the way, you got to explain what hebby is to some people.
Hebby is a short-billed spearfish. It's my interest in hebby started well before I even moved to Hawaii. Short-billed spearfish or hebby are enigmatic. They're biologically enigmatic. There is a couple thousand metric tons of hebby caught a year, and it's a widely edible.
It's lovely
and it's delicious.
You bet.
And it's caught in
decent
amounts, and it's an important food fish here in from Hawaii. Mm-hmm. But biologically, they fill an interesting niche in which they are both an important predator, but also important prey for some of our larger pelagics. And we see these weird shifts in the when you go further in the Eastern Pacific of catch rates. Of hebby.
What about size? Are there difference in size there too?
There's some. Yeah, I mean, you get some big ones here.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that when in the Eastern Pacific, we were seeing when I was working there 3 or 4 years ago, nobody ever caught short-billed spearfish. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, when you weren't seeing any sailfish.
Yeah, what's that? Yeah.
And let me mind you that sailfish are caught in the bazillions in the Eastern Pacific off of Guatemala, and Costa Rica, and Panama. In Mexico, but all of a sudden you're not seeing sailfish and you're seeing all these spearfish.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really interesting environmental thing going on that it'd be interesting to see if there's a linkage between the Eastern Pacific and Hawaii. Why is that important for management? Well, we need to find out if that's happening or if we have a completely localized stock of short-billed spearfish that maybe we can assess them and keep an eye on them, because what we don't want to happen is hammer them so hard that they don't come back. Mm-hmm. These things may have recruitment levels, which is the amount of reproduction that they have they can contribute to stock, that may be out of this world right now, and we don't know if that's a stock. So we need to do some assessment work on them to find out what's going on with those populations, because they are very volatile.
Do they ever run in large numbers, or are they mostly small units, or is it, do we know?
When you mean small units, you mean like in dozens of
dozens,
fish?
Dozens rather than hundreds more.
In some of their catch records we've seen in the longline fishery, they'll catch, I've seen up to 10 fish per 1,000 hooks.
That's pretty big.
Which is a pretty big amount. Yeah. And then I've seen some catch records here in Hawaii that some small boat folks trolling off of Oahu have caught up to about 12 to 15.
Interestingly enough, a lot of our guys end up going fishing in out of the long range fleet out of San Diego, or they go down to Cabo or other places where you can actually get in tournaments where you'll catch 100 fish a day. They're just everywhere.
That's striped marlin. Yeah. They're catching, so down in the Bisbee's Black and Blue tournament a couple years ago,
amazing.
They were catching, I think right before that tournament, they were catching too many stripers and not enough blues, and that I heard reports of charters running half days because nobody wanted to book a full day because they were just getting so tired.
They're getting tired of fighting fish. Can you imagine fighting, everybody here says, let's go fishing.
Striped marlin,
there you go and catching.
Striped marlin's interesting is the catch rates have gone down for a lot of the fisheries, but you're seeing this huge bump in catch in striped marlin catch rates in the Eastern Pacific. So we don't know if those fish are linked somehow to the Hawaiian Islands. Same thing with spearfish.
Are they getting bigger there? Because I do know that we had for a long time here, a stripey over 100 was very rare.
Yeah, I don't think those stripers there get as big as they do down in the Coral Sea or in the far western Pacific.
They get pretty big there.
They get some
pounds.
Big ones. Yeah. They get a 350 pounder.
Yeah, wow.
Whew. Yeah, that's a big striper.
Big fish, yeah. But so the object or the idea behind the hebby tagging project is obviously to get a better handle Are you worried about where they're going, or how many of them there are? Both.
We want to start off with looking at the spatial constraint of. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at year deployments of these satellite tags to look at where they're moving in time and space relative to the Hawaiian Islands. So there's been some preliminary tagging data on 30 to 40 days was the max, that showed that they kind of hang around even within that window, the Hawaiian Islands. And we had one fish I saw tag track that circumvented the Big Island, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. That's pretty interesting. But we want to look at, on a time scale, on a management time scale, how much these fish are moving. Yeah, yeah. And so if we need to, that will determine if we can do a stock assessment on species.
Yeah, and the reason I ask, Mark, is because a lot of times our audience says, yeah, you know, we talk about these things. Do you really believe they're accurate? Well, you know, in years past, you would have had to say probably not. But I mean, now I just think not just of the method, but of the frequency of these things. Sooner or later, all of this data starts to mesh in where it becomes valuable. Yeah. Not just garbage in, garbage out for somebody to stick at the computer.
Yeah. And there's such little information on short-billed spearfish. They're the most enigmatic of all the billfishes. So it's a good. This is a good start.
The reason I like them, they fit in the fish box.
You know? I think they're pretty tasty.
Yeah, they are very tasty. And it's. I don't want to. I've never had a tough, stringy one either. The meat is really, really, really nice. Anyway. So that project, when you have a project like that, who's funding it?
So right now, this is all internal. Mm-hmm. We actually are looking at sources of funding, outside sources. I don't think I'm at liberty to talk about those.
Yeah,
right
I don't
now,
mean me specifically.
But we're looking for getting external funding for the implementation of the tags. Mm-hmm. And so I'll be working with some partners eventually in contacting some folks in Kona. That we already kind of have are that we're kind of in talks with, and also some fishermen here on Oahu.
Okay, we talked last week and a little bit earlier today about I don't want to say renewed interest, but a concentrated interest in small boat fishing. And, you know, I do know that that is the majority of people here that don't consider themselves commercial because they're not out there 7 days a week fishing. They are commercial in that they're selling part of their catch or trading part of their catch. This small boat group, the small boat fishery is quite large, isn't it?
It is quite large. You know, we've seen over 5 years, a couple hundred thousand trips that are reported to the DLNR. Yeah. or to the Department of Aquatic Resources here in Hawaii. And so there's a sizable volume of fish. Mm-hmm. They, you know, the small boat fishery catches a significant portion of the billfishes that are caught
in total in Hawaii.
In some years, half of all the ahi, and then in recent years, most of the mahi-mahi caught. Mm-hmm. And so they're an important fishery, and they're economically important. They need to also, we need to incentivize them because they do provide a quality product to the folks here in the islands.
Well, I'm telling you, you know, I've been down at the auction, as you have many times, you go down to United Fisheries, and these guys, these small boat guys that are coming in, their fish are in top shape. They know how to get the value out of their fish because they know how to treat them, how to handle them. And they are of a size that they can easily handle. You know what I mean? You can't have a little boat go out and catch 20 big ahi because they just can't handle it. But these guys can go out, they can catch 100 mahi-mahi and handle them.
They can handle, they can catch a couple thousand pounds of fresh product and come back and offload. These boats are, like I said, there's a science and an art. They're at the intersection of a lot of these captains I've talked to are extremely talented.
Oh yeah,
and they know how to read the seamounts. They know how to read currents. They know what to do and when to do it. It is impressive.
Isn't it sometimes a shame that the numbers are missing from that group? Because it would make a lot of management better if you had a better idea. I'm not just talking about when you can close an area or limit or restrict or anything. I'm just talking about when you can actually lean back on your science and have faith in it.
Yeah, well, they do report their data to the state of Hawaii.
Right.
Through the fisher reporting system. There, I would say, having experienced with that data set, there are some issues that, at least from a scientific point of view, that need to be fixed and repaired. We need to separate groups of fisheries, because a lot of these folks, small boat fisheries that come out, they we could separate them into guilds, I would say. They operate differently. They have different capacities.
Different effort, everything.
Honestly, I'm looking and talking to, looking at some of the records and then talking to some of these fishermen, experience plays a huge key role. There's varying fishing powers. So there's so much to be done, a lot of work that needs to be done. And that's kind of where we want to get a first crack at it. And then also look at and take a crack at the maybe holding some workshops in the future and working with some of these small boat guys to use their data in management and science.
I want to tell you, gang, that if you were with us earlier, we were talking about this very subject. And that is, you know, if you think that there are less fish in some areas, that might be true. And it also might be true that when Dr. Fritcher just said that it's amazing the difference between the catching ability of the people that are fishing. Because you can get two same boats, same equipment, same guys. One guy's got a lot more experience than the other and goes out and catches 10 times more fish. Does that mean that there's 10 times more fish where he is? No, it means he's a pretty good fisherman.
Yep.
And we got a lot of them here.
And there's a way and there's means to statistically tease that out to build good indices of local abundance. Another thing, an idea that we're pushing out here is that there is some conflict between the longline fishery and the small boat fishery. There has been historically. We have enclosures that prohibit small boat that close parts of our Hawaiian waters due to for various reasons. They may or may not have positive or negative impacts on the small boat fishery. But one thing that we want to do is to bridge that gap and bridge some of these differences. And with the advent of electronic reporting in the longline fishery, meaning we're going to be getting a real-time data stream of information of catch reporting, maybe that can make an opportunity for an inner section of the small boat fishery, so the small boat fishery can make, knowing how the longline fishery is operating, they can make informed decisions on how much effort, how much fuel they want to burn.
Yeah, and
that would help them.
And I'm going to tell you, it's a big help. As Mark was explaining, this is in equal time. And your filing, your catch reports is so much easier now. If you don't want to do it, your grandkids can do it. I mean, it is so easy to get online and do your stuff. But I mean, I was down at POP again the other day, as I'm there very often, as you know, Mark, and I'm so encouraged by the, I don't want to say that longliners and non-longliners are in clenching each other in beautiful warm body hugs, because I do know that there's still some space in between it. But once we found out that we have our own, indigenous Ahi and Big Eye that's close in, that we can't say the fish are being caught, they're not coming in, we don't have fish because the longliners are catching them all where we can't go fish, which was always a big concern, wasn't it? And still seems to be a little bit.
There is a little bit of concern. There's a concern that you may be having over depletion of these transient fish that are coming. I wouldn't say depletion, sorry. I would say you would have sort of a gauntlet of fishing effort outside of the range of the small boat fishery that is precluding these transient fish from reaching the vessel range of a small boat fishery.
Good point.
And that's a legitimate concern. But one thing that's to be taken into consideration is not just the U.S. fishing effort, but we're seeing an increase in Korean fishing effort south of the Hawaiian exclusive economic zone.
How close do you has it been reported? How close?
Based on what I've looked at, catch records, and then the Korean and Taiwanese and Japanese showed their maps at the ISC meeting last year and showed a lot of fishing effort just outside of the U.S. EEZ.
Yeah, and we're talking just outside.
Yeah,
they know where they are,
and they're following. And there's also outside of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands where you have the Monument closure. There are a lot of fishing effort right outside that zone because there's what's called the spillover effect. There's this thing that you think if you have a preserved area that there's going to be a spillover, a surplus of individuals protected, which may not be true.
It's probably not true, to be honest.
There's all sorts of theories there, but nevertheless, we're seeing a high amount of fishing effort outside the EZ. Yeah. And that brings us up to these closures that we're talking about in spatial management, is that if you want to close an area of fishing, all you're end up ultimately going to do is just concentrate fishing effort and displace it elsewhere.
Sure.
And that can actually have worse and worse impacts.
Obviously, if you keep going back to a smaller area and taking everything you can out of there, it's going to affect the population.
And it's going to decrease economic the economic viability, and in some cases may actually increase the interaction rate with protected species.
Yeah, so. And you know, gang, one of the reasons I couldn't wait, I almost want to jump ahead of our schedule here for a minute and talk to Dr. Fritzen about an upcoming trip he's going to be making. It's called spatial management. We've been touching on it a little bit. Spatial management, a lot of factors go into doing that to say, okay, how are you going to manage this? And when you start talking about spatial management in blue water, that must put even more unknowns into it. I mean, how do you make the decision? Not only is there going to be management in that area, but how big is that area?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, I don't know where to start. Quite frankly, there's been a big push in the recent years on area-based management tools, which many folks in their mind's eye see that being synonymous with marine protected areas enclosures.
Yeah.
And there's been a push on the international level. There's been three sessions at the United Nations on what's called BB&J, which is the Convention for the Protection of Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction.
Oh, boy.
That's a mouthful.
I should say.
But we call it BB&J.
BB&J.
So BB&J has gone through three negotiations. It's supposed to go through a fourth and final. I think it'll go to a fifth session because there's still so much squabbling between a lot of the those involved in the negotiations. But what BB&J is doing is setting goals and setting the stage for how we manage high seas.
Mm-hmm.
And the high seas, distant water regions, are waters outside 200 miles of a sovereign state or territory.
Yeah, so it's pretty easy to get out of a pencil and find out what parts of the Pacific, the Atlantic, what parts of all the
international
oceans.
Waters.
Yeah, international waters, yeah.
And so one of the issues is it gives rights and it to other countries that may not have ports or access for mineral rights, marine genetic material. I don't really want to get into that too much. But also, there's a lot of issues with marine traffic. The shipping industry is actually very, very concerned.
You bet. All of a sudden, if you have a bunch of, you know, small and medium-sized boats in sea lanes, you're looking for problems.
That's an issue, but also in when we start talking about ownership of the high seas and making it equitable between the global community, that comes a lot of issues, a lot of problems, you know, arise. And in the terms of fisheries right now, there's this big push to implement high seas closures or area-based management to conserve biodiversity. No. Now, you brought up before we started the show, asked a good question. Well, who's going to enforce these?
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's us. Yeah, are we going to have to be policemen for the whole world?
Yeah. You know? It's the U.S., yeah. New Zealand, Australia, these countries that have developed coast guards and capacity are going to be the ones holding the bag and enforcement. And then also a lot of times when area-based, when these area-based or spatial closures are implemented, science is not not the impetus. And one of the things that the United States is not a signatory of the United Nations Convention for Law of the Sea.
Okay.
For multiple reasons. But the U.S. is positioned right now at BB&J is that for any area-based management or closure, it has to be based on science.
Okay.
It has to have some sort of monitoring and performance metric. And then also it has to be agreed upon by multiple parties that are involved. And so what I mean by that is if the UN or this BB&J convention wants to close an area, let's say, off of the main Hawaiian Islands, they need to be consulting with the U.S. and anybody who utilizes those waters.
And gang, here's the deal. Mark's got to put on a big hat, and he's going to be in charge of something in Rome. I mean, I know it's both an awesome opportunity, but a big responsibility. And I don't know if a gathering like this has taken place before or not. Is this something brand new? Is it something that's ongoing?
It's not a new concept. So we're putting together a workshop on the spatial management of blue water ecosystems, which is the pelagic environment. There was a workshop done, which was a compendium of science projects and research that CI put together, which was good. CI is a group called Conservation International. In fact, Jack Kittinger here in Hawaii was one of the conveners for that. But what we're looking for now is not just putting a compendium of science and like just a and just, you know, a show and tell. We want to develop ultimately what is best practices in implementing spatial closures and management in fisheries and the pelagic ecosystem, because the reality is a lot of the issues of how we develop spatial management is dependent on how much these fish move, our target species.
Sure.
What is the goal? Is the goal to reduce interaction with protected species? Is it to protect and conserve and manage our target species? And is it for economics? Are we looking to maximize economic output or make or create some sort of social goal that we close an area to make one area have more access to the fishing resources?
And, you know, gang, what he's talking about is a lot of people with different – they're looking at the same piece of real estate or ocean – but with mighty different, you know, plans, you know. And so that must mean that it's going to be a real eye-opener to some, and probably saying, and this comes up all the time, I don't know how science answers the question. There are more of us on the planet every year. That means there's more people that have to eat everything, including fish. And there's no reason to believe that the fish stocks are increasing to meet that demand. It quite possibly is the opposite.
It is quite the opposite. And I think, and as we talked about, as I mentioned to you again over the break, is that for somebody who is not involved in the fishing community or is versed in fishery science, when they see, let's propose a closure, let's close an area to fishing, that's somehow going to repopulate a fish stock. That is just displacing fishing effort elsewhere. That demand is still there. The capacity to fish is still there. So if you want to manage and do proper management and do some sort of conservation measures, you need to start looking at fishing capacity and limited entry in some regards. And so what we're seeing here is this big push for spatial management as a catch-all for reaching biodiversity goals.
Yeah, and that's another thing, the problem of it. And all of what we're talking about in the West, in the WP Council, and you got to go check it, wpcouncil.org. Do this often, particularly because I told you, and I keep telling you about the new and improved the website. It really is. It shows you what the responsibility of the council is, but it also leaves you with a lot of chance to think. And I think that part of what the all the councils do, and because of Magnuson, is that 40 years ago, none of us listening to this program would have known anything. And now we're getting a great degree of it. So the challenge, obviously, is going to be when you go off to this big thing in Rome, outside of having lots of really probably good pizza, that it's going to spur additional conversation and force people to take some reality checks on what we're really doing with the oceans. Is that fair assessment?
Yeah, and what we're trying to do is we want to convene. And so this week, actually, because this is in 5.5 months, so we need to put together invites and set, which is, it's the heat is on right now.
Yeah, I should say.
But what we're doing is we're prioritizing scientific experts in the field. So we have a list of scientists that we are trying to invite. We also have members of environmental groups, of environmental NGOs, have them involved. There's actually some very good experts, like Hugh Possingham, who works for the Nature Conservancy, who is an expert in spatial management. We have experts down in Indian Ocean. So we're having this is a global effort to invite experts in the field. And then we want to have the participation of the industry.
How much is being fueled urgency-wise by the new look everybody's taking at global warming and sea level changes and temperature changes and everything else?
Mike, it's a huge impact. The Marshall Islands are sinking. The studies have shown that you have this shift in biomass for some of our tuna species in the Pacific. So some of these island countries that are experiencing a fortuitous amount of fish within their EEZs may not have that in the future.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have some winners. So you have winners and losers with climate change. But the big thing is now, you know, you're looking at the issue with with that just sort of it's not just fisheries, but you're looking at water supply for some of these fishing communities. You're looking at the fact that the Marshall Islands, they're losing ground, mm-hmm. right? So there's
space.
A lot.
There's not a lot to begin with.
And so you're looking at a lot of real, I think, holistic issues here. And climate change has an impact on how fish move.
Yeah, you cannot ignore it. I'm not. I think a lot of our audience says it happens anyway, with or without us. I don't think that's true anymore. I think there's so many of us that we are impacting it. And when they say, yeah, but what about this? There's that volcano coming up underneath the sea and it's putting more pollution into the planet than we all are. Well, yeah, it's true. But what we're putting in is undeniable.
Yeah, and
in some respects, anyway.
Well, when it comes to that, you know, I don't want to get too off topic, but a lot of folks will see these things and they use it as confirmation bias to essentially say, well, oh, look at this. It's the coldest July we've ever had, or it's the hottest January.
Oh, wait,
it's like, that's the point.
I was thinking about this last night. We've had some stinking hot here, right?
Yeah.
And now they're talking about, it's going to be record cold. Well, okay, now, how much does global warming have to do with freezing? Well, a lot. You know?
A lot of people don't realize is that there's the exchange of energy. If one area is getting warmer, that doesn't necessarily mean the whole world's getting warmer.
Yeah.
And then also on top of that, when you have anomalous weather patterns, that is usually not the same. So people also confuse weather and climate.
Yeah.
But when you have these anomalous climate events, you're seeing things that are always a record this, record that. That's not necessarily a good thing. That doesn't mean that the Earth is not, you know, it's not staying at its homeostasis, which
however,
is not good.
However, I got to tell you, I saw some pictures last week of the Hudson River when it was really, really bad, and the Hudson River today. And believe it or not, and you can see this in a lot of other places, if you turn around, you can erase some of the bad that we've done by just being a little bit more careful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is measurable, isn't it, sometimes?
Yeah, and you look at, what's it, the CFCs, when people worry about the ozone.
Yeah.
You know, people looking at controlling
deodorant spray or whatever, right?
Yeah. All the pollution that we did in the 70s and 60s and 70s. I mean, there are actionable solutions, you know. And then, but going back to our fisheries issue, when it comes to spatially managing fish stocks, you know, what we're doing, what's happening in the environment is a huge, huge driver, and then creates an added layer of complexity.
Well, it's like they say, keep calm and carry on. Yep. Dr. Mark Fish, thank you so much, Mark.
Yes, sir.
Nice catching up with you again. And gang, remember, if you want to find out what the council is up to, jump on their new website. It is really, really, really good. Go find my picture. I'll sign it for you. And it's at wpcouncil.org. WPCouncil.org. And don't forget, if you want to see something on the, hear something on the show, or see something on the website, let us know. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Go catch some fish. Have some fun. See you next time. Bye.